Toot, toot.
Beep.
Excellent.
Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar, episode 146. It is 21st of June. I'm Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Chris Thurston.
And...
Pip.
And special guest...
John Roberts. I just won't go away.
We have ascertained that there's no news at all this week. Nothing has happened at all since the last podcast. And so I guess we're going to talk about what we've been playing.
Well, we didn't do it last week, because last week was all news, all the time, and questions.
We can talk more about what we've been playing. What have you been playing, Chris?
I have been playing House of the Dying Sun.
Yes.
A game whose name I have consistently gotten wrong since I bought it at lunchtime today. It was formerly known as Enemy Starfighter, which is a much better name for this game, because it sort of gives you a sense of what it is. Because it's a starfighter game in which you are perhaps the enemy, and you also have enemies and so on. Why did they rename it? Did they rename it for, you know, was a lawyer waved at them? Or?
I think so. I can't remember if I heard the details.
Wave a lawyer at somebody.
But they do, you know, like...
a legal challenge.
These things come out all the time, you know, that...
No Man's Sky.
Came out recently. No Man's Sky was almost having to be renamed to No Man's...
Place.
Up there. Because of a copyright threat from actual BSkyB.
Trademark.
Sorry, I forget that you used to write about IP law. I should be careful. For whatever reason, they renamed House of the Dying. I keep wanting to say House of the Rising Sun, or House of the Dead, or House of Cards.
House of the Rising Dead would be a good
House of the Rising
title.
Dead, yeah.
Typing of the Dying Sun.
House of the Dawn of the Dead. Typing of the House of the Dawn.
House of Starring Sun.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what it is it's like a very honed, beautifully produced indie space dogfighting game that I would describe as somewhere between X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, Conflict Free Space, Descent.
Hang on, what? Conflict Free Space?
Conflict Free Space.
Fine.
Was a game from the noughties.
No conflict space.
Cornflakes.
No conflict sky.
Freeze spades. And Homeworld. Like, Homeworld specifically for the way it looks.
Yeah.
It's a game of like beautiful orange nebulas, and then beautiful blue nebulas, and then beautiful pastel green nebulas, and all the ships are sort of angular and... John, you'll know what this is called. What's it called when they're all like a colour, but not like textures with bumps?
So they're mostly just colour and lighting.
Yeah, it's like it's highly abstract. Reminds me a bit of flotilla, actually, an ancient
branding. Yeah, I think everyone has their own word for it because that's what art is.
Yeah,
but
shit.
Wow.
Flat shaded, maybe faceted. Yeah.
It's not cell shaded, which is because it's not at all.
Call that 8-bit.
Yeah.
If in doubt, it's 8-bit.
Nor is it 8-bit, because it looks like 3D used to look, but with anti-aliasing. Bit like if you were playing Virtua Fighter, but the people were spaceships.
I think they figured out that
it was
like,
all smooth.
That textures barely matter in a space game. Like, or maybe the textures on your ship you'd see, but everything else spends 90% of its time so far away that you can't really tell that it's not
indeed.
Textured.
It's got a beautiful interface. It is gorgeous. Like it's, I don't mean that it's sort of doesn't feel low production value in any way. I've been playing a lot of Elite recently. It makes an interesting contrast with that because that's an enormously high resolution, high fidelity game, as you know, John.
I have worked on Elite.
Indeed. Full disclosure.
I made a crate.
Indeed.
It's my legacy.
Sometimes I scoop them. it looks great and. It has Homeworld's sort of like slightly sort of retro in the sense of old like worn Jack Vance paperback sci-fi feel to it. It's got a lot of the way it kind of presents itself is you are the last surviving member of the Royal Guard of the Emperor, and the Emperor's been killed, and your mission is to hunt down and assassinate the 12 traitor lords.
Traitor lords.
And you're given lots of reasons in the mission descriptions why these people are all shits, but it's sort of left ambiguous enough that you are possibly the bad guy.
Yeah, I feel like the bad guy, because it's literally like, you have to murder them, and then sometimes like make an example of the workers is one of the sub-objectives.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Wow, this doesn't sound like I'm on the right side.
Almost as if you're the enemy starfighter from the House of the Dying Sun. But yeah, it's got this the kind of use of like regal titles, and everyone's a lord of space of one kind or another, gives it like quite a Dune-y kind of feel as well. It's like very much that kind
it's
of
got
sci-fi.
This really nice kind of aesthetic to the storytelling, or the sort of the dramatic presentation, where the intro is like just about 7 lines of text, each coming up one after the other on a black screen, and each
with
one
there's
like
bell.
A drum beat, or a bell, yeah, sorry. Yeah. And then in the missions themselves, there's like banging war drums, and it's very like...
It's very Battlestar, actually. The soundtrack has that sort of Battlestar. I also like Battlestar. It has a really interesting audio design where everything is very, very muffled in space. Like, it does the thing of the only audio you're hearing is the air in your cockpit vibrating with the sound of whatever's happening outside your ship, which actually makes it a very quiet game, which is, you know, it doesn't feel like... I saw someone in the Steam reviews actually complaining about that, saying they didn't like it. So I guess it's a stylistic choice that people might not resonate with. But it feels great for that reason. And mechanically, there's a whole bunch of interesting things they've done with sort of the rhythm of it, because it's quite simple in some ways. Like, you pick a loadout for your ship and you slot in upgrades in various slots that you can unlock with points that you get from doing harder versions of the missions. And actually, the thing that is closest to is Galaxy, in my opinion, in terms of slotting up in upgrades, although it's not a roguelike in any way or shape or form. And once you take your upgraded ship or ships into battle, and then you pick which one you're going to control. And then after that, it's a really sort of honed dogfighting game. So there's not a lot of enemy types, not a lot of ship types for you, but there's enough configurations of abilities and weapons and so on that it does have some... There's some, you know, genuine depth to it. But there's a few really nice things they've done. One thing is by holding the space bar or one of the buttons on a pad, you go into what they call drift mode, but it's really like flight assist off from Elite, where you are suddenly affected by Newtonian physics. So whatever kind of flight correction is happening to make you feel like you're flying in atmosphere goes away, which allows you to spin around. But I really like that being a toggle. It's basically space crouch, in that it's the thing you do to kind of like, you know, reposition or even to protect yourself by sort of like twisting in space. And it works, you know, in Elite, that's a whole ship-wide setting that you've got to switch off. And it sort of factors into a bunch of other things. In this, it is natural as like holding down the crouch key in an FPS, and it kind of becomes a reflex like that.
So does that solve the classic space dogfighting problem of just pulling up forever?
Yeah.
Until hopefully your target has a slightly wider turning circle than you do.
It doesn't feel like... Yeah, for that reason, it actually never really feels like that. Like, I think one thing I noticed is that the AI tend not to do it very much, even on the harder settings. And maybe that's something that'll come in later in the campaign. I've only played about an hour of it. But I spent a lot of that time trying to crack one of the early missions on the absolute hardest setting that it tells you have to do after you can come back with some upgrades. And I did it anyway. But like they seem to use it less than you do. But I think that works because it gives you that sense of sort of like dominance, because it's always like you're outnumbered. You're always outnumbered, but you're also always the aggressor, which gives you an interesting feeling of being like kind of a badass. Because if you're being sent in to just slaughter loads of people and blow up someone's capital ship, and you're alone in a little fighter, then you must be amazing. But it's got some really interesting little mechanics. So every mission has bonus objectives. If you bring in a fleet with you, then you can switch to other ships when you die. And then you can earn reinforcements by chaining kills. And then after a certain amount of time in any mission, sort of almost like a rapid, you know, accelerated version of FTL, the enemy flagship will show up. And if the enemy flagship shows up, it's not game over instantly, but you're probably fucked. Like, you won't survive very long against it. So you're against the clock in every mission in a way that actually doesn't feel bad, because it's quite a clear stakes thing. And as soon as you completed all the objectives, then your only objective is to point at this waypoint marker and hold the hyperdrive button until you get out. And that creates a lot of cool moments where it has that sort of high repetition rate of something like almost like Hotline Miami, where you go straight back in and you try it again, and this time you go and blow up those fighters first, then you take out those escorts, then you do this and you do that, and when you do it all in just enough time to kind of warp out as the enemy flagship is warping in, that feels really good. So I really like it so far. I understand it's not an especially long game. People are saying it takes about 5-6 hours to complete. It's in Steam Early Access at the moment at £15, so probably $20. But it's like finished. This is a bug fixing and polish early access. It's not going to get very much more content. It might get a wave survival mode, and it's not. It feels finished, honestly, in its current state.
Did you play as like different ships?
I haven't yet. I know there's like one fighter and then various sizes of capital ship that you can play as.
Because I remember Graham talked about this game before when it was called Enemy Starfighter, and the thing he liked about it was that he said it felt like flying a gun, because when you fired like your shotgun thing, the whole front of your ship would kind of like recoil back into your hull, and I haven't found that with the default ship.
I haven't found that at all, yeah.
And it was actually like a little bit of a... I don't know if it was that or the muted sound thing or something else, but I didn't get a lot of like punch from the weapons. I mean, no less so than any other space game, but I just haven't ever really enjoyed a dogfighting space game, and I thought this one might be the one. But yeah, I didn't quite get the punch from that. I played it in VR, which is... I only played it very briefly, and I was bad at it. but it was an interesting experience, because it began as like one of the most mind-blowing things, and I said, oh my god, I think 6 times out loud in the first like few minutes of playing it, because the sensation of, first of all, like you're just, you see the kind of the system that you're in almost like a map view, which is weird in VR, because you're sort of zoomed out, but your face is right in it as well, which is strange. And it's beautiful and amazing, and then as soon as you select a ship and go inside it, just seeing the ship in front of you in VR is amazing, because it just looks fucking enormous. Like, I think on a flat monitor, any of these games, you're probably flying quite a big ship and you see it extend in front of you, but you don't really get a sense of how far is it extending in front of you. Is it just, is it that size on screen because it's close or because it's long? whereas in VR, you can see fucking hell, this thing is like 70 foot long and made of like enormous amount of metal. And so that was incredible. And then as soon as I like moved it with the thumbstick, just playing on a gamepad, like the whole illusion was gone. And I know like there's a certain amount of just space is counterintuitive anyway. So like, but I push a little thumbstick a little way and this massive metal thing just kind of swivels on a dime and I no longer have any sense of its weight. And I fire my guns and like, they are quite mechanical little things. Like the little shotgun thing is a sort of little sphere type thing. And you see it like sort of rotating and reloading and stuff. And it feels quite mechanical, but it doesn't like rock your whole ship in the way that I sort of thought it was going to. And so, yeah, I ended up feeling like it didn't. I think it's partly that, and probably mostly just controlling on a gamepad feels weird to me after... I should be using like a joystick and stuff, but what I really want is a space game like this where you use motion controls and you're just walking around the cockpit and you have to like run over to the dashboard and interact with weird dials and twizzle the dials with your hands and stuff like that.
One of the problems we ran into on Elite pretty early on was the Douglas Adams problem, where space is big, right? It's really big and it's really empty and quite boring. So when you're having dogfights, there's almost no danger from the environment. Do they have like asteroid fields or like tiny black holes or anything that...
Every mission is sort of hand design hazard map, basically. So there are asteroids and debris and things like that. Also, I found that because of the way the physics model works, collisions between ships are surprisingly possible. Mm. Like, one of the commands you can give your wingmen when you have wingmen is ram my target. Like, you can choose like bomb my target, attack my target, escort me, and ram my target, which is like, I guess, you spending your extra lives in order to do extra damage when you need it. Again, lends into the you're the baddie kind of theme. But because there's quite a lot of, especially if you use drift a lot, there's a lot of in sort of inertia on your movement. You pick up speed and you find it quite hard to lose it. And the faster you're going, the harder it is to turn quickly, because you can see all around your ship. You have these like mobility thrusters and sort of all around. So when you try and rotate, you see that your ship is trying to thrust itself in different directions. And that I've had moments where like I've been diving to try and take out the last ship I need to. Or like racing to try and blow them up because I can see the countdown. I've got 8 seconds until the enemy flagship shows up. And you can get into a situation where you cripple it, but it doesn't explode straight away and you can't turn out of the way. So you just smack into the side of it and then you restart the mission because you smacked into the side of it rather than destroy it. I think Like, I agree with you that it doesn't feel punchy, but for me that helps sell the illusion. Like, one of my favorite things, Elite does this really well, actually. One of my favorite things about space dogfights is that a lot of the time the end of them's quite subtle. Like, I like the moment, like, a ship fails and you just sit, like, spin off into the void, or maybe blow up, or maybe just be sort of, you know, destroyed. And there's a nice feeling enemy starfighter where you can, like, if you're leading your shots well and you can see the enemy health bar, so you can see, like, well, I've fired enough now that they're going to die, even though they haven't died yet. There's a cool feeling to, like, switching targets, and then, like, a couple of seconds later, the bullets you just fired finish off the guy you were aiming at then. He, like, sort of shoots past you and his ship disintegrates, and it's all kind of, like, quite quiet against the void. It's just like a thud you hear through your cockpit. Like, that's... Yeah. That stuff, it really sells it to me, I think.
You say, like, no scope, noob,
yeah,
fly off into the sun.
You can 360 people because of the, you know, because of the drift feature. I hear what people say, like, people on Steam seem to be saying that it feels quite short, and once you've kind of done everything, you've done everything. And that, I can imagine, maybe being an issue. Like, so it was originally going to have randomly generated levels and maybe have more of a roguelike structure, more like Galaxy, actually. And I believe they stepped away from that because they felt like it works better with proper authored scenarios that have been designed to be fun, which I can understand. But for that reason, it feels like it will need some, like, or that it would benefit enormously from a mission editor and Steam Workshop support, which almost gets them out of the not enough to do after you've been, you know, beaten all. I think it's 14 missions, and they each have 3 difficulty settings that ramp up quite a lot. And there are multiple ships and things, but I can imagine once you've gotten through that, maybe running out of steam with it. But so far, I really like it. Spaceships. Surprising nobody.
What have you been playing, Pip?
Well, after all of the new games that happened last week, I went back to Warcraft 3.
The beginning.
Well, I feel like we talked about Warcraft 3 not that long ago, not in terms of playing it, but just talking about the plot.
Maybe when we were talking about the movie?
Yeah, you were saying, like, that. I was talking about a scene with Arthas, and you were saying that still echoes in one of the rooms in WoW.
Oh, yeah. Was this a conversation we were having, but not on the podcast?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Continue.
I don't know. Yeah, so I was playing that, and I've sort of been sort of chipping away at it on and off the last couple of weeks, but sort of only doing, you know, a level every few days just when I had a bit of spare time and stuff. And it's so weird going back to it after so much time and getting to know the character forms in Dota so well over, like, thousands of hours. Sort of, because I haven't played pretty much any Warcraft game in between, I don't think, at all, except for maybe booting up WoW if I needed to write something for work. And so sort of going in and suddenly, like, Jaina turns up and she's like, oh, mate, I can summon a water elemental. And you're like, what are you doing with Morphling? That's weird.
Put him down.
I know. It's like, surely he should be really overpowered by now. Oh, okay, fine. He's just a minion at this point. A spell-brought minion.
Origin story.
So, yeah. So
also, she's Crystal Maiden.
Well, yeah, but also, like, you know, you sort of, you're faffing around with your rifleman and suddenly realise, oh, that's Sniper, but there's, like, 4 of him and they're tiny. So, yeah, like, that was just a bit of a weird sort of ongoing mental double take process, even though obviously the origins of Dota 2 and Dota and the original mod and, you know, all of that kind of stuff are things that I know. It's just that it's odd sort of seeing it and going back to it in that way. But I'm also really not covering myself in glory. It's kind of like I've forgotten how to Warcraft, which is shameful given the amount of time I spent on it when I was doing my dissertation. I was going to say when I was playing my dissertation.
Don't you just build up a big enough army and then right-click on the enemy base?
Right, that's been my strategy all along. But at this point, I'm on the, I think it's the 5th mission of the human campaign, where Arthas is like, oh, Jaina, like, run and deliver a message to someone about something. And she's all, oh, fine. I'm paraphrasing because I can't really remember. I'm not very good with plots. And so, yeah, and you're sort of, you have to, basically the game, the level takes half an hour because you're waiting for Uther to show up. And
you mean Omni Knight?
Yes. And that's the amount of time it will take. But, and there's a secondary thing where you have to stop an infection from being brought to a bunch of nearby villages through some, you know, infected grain. And I was doing it and I was just like, oh, this is kind of, I'm just about sort of holding on and clawing my way through it kind of thing. And then it got to a few minutes from the end. I'd absolutely lost the optional mission. Everything was infected. No one had any grain. There was famine across the map. And then, like, everybody was kind of knocking on my base, and I was just like, this has not gone well, and so many of my people had died. But I was looking at my buildings, and as long as you had buildings, you were okay. And I figured that it would take the enemy slightly more time to knock down my buildings than I had left until Uther got there. So I was just like watching it in horror, not really able to do anything, with just, you know, one worker left. And in the end, I was just like, oh, crap, they're actually, like, they're going to beat him by about half a minute. So I tried to get the worker to run off into the woods where he could build a farm.
Like a new town, damn you.
Exactly. Just anything I could build quickly. But two undead had spotted him, like, tailing him. So I was trying to lead them all around the map so that I could keep the peasant alive so that he could then at some point shake them off to build a farm so that Uther could show up and be like, seriously, we've got one farm. I suppose you completed the mission. And yeah, he died with 8 seconds left.
Oh, man.
That was soul destroying. So I rage quit.
I know in StarCraft, there's like particular buildings you should build in that situation because they have loads of HP, and the HP, like the build time is either fixed or doesn't vary proportionally with HP. So there's like, I think if you're a Terran and you build like an armory that, because it's really tough, you get more HP per second as you're building it than other buildings. Yeah. I'm sure that's probably true of Warcraft as well.
Yeah, it was, well, because they killed him like with maybe a minute left, and then the last of the towers fell like with a few seconds to go, which was I did not feel good about that. But yeah, it used to be that I would just speed build, you know, a whole massive army, stomp somewhere, and then just kick it over. Yeah. What happened to those days?
Yeah, that's the great pleasure of an RTS for me. The more Blizzard get inventive with their missions, the less I like them, because I just want to like steamroll someone.
Yeah, I think this one is expecting me to use tactics, and I'm just like, this is just, I might just cheat.
There's only one RTS mission where they script a bunch of stuff and I still liked it, or it was actually better than a standard skirmish, which was in Dawn of War Soulstorm, which was like the second expansion pack for Dawn of War 1. And it introduced, I think you were playing as the Dark Eldar, and there's a mission where you want to take down, I think, the Sisters of Battle stronghold, and they have an immortal angel that renders everything near it invincible. But it is, in some sense, like powered by these statues of itself. And there's, I think, four of them. And so you go and attack a statue, but he just shows up immediately, and he makes not only the statue invincible, but also all of his defenders invincible, and you can't possibly defeat him. And so it's one of the few setups where, like, you legitimately have to do a ruse. You have to do a fake attack on one of the things, and then mash your real force next to a different one. And then only once the angel turns up to defend your smaller force, attack with the bigger force on the other shrine, and then take them out that way. And that was like, wow, I used tactics to solve a problem. And it wasn't just like, that is obviously what they intended to do, but it, like, they didn't tell me to do it. I had to think of it, and then I did it, and it worked.
Mm. It'll be interesting to see which side of this Dawn of War 3 ends up on. Because the small amount of gameplay we got from, I think it's from E3.
Yeah. The PC gamer show, you PC might find.
It looked literally like attack move to win. It was just literally just steamrolling forces across some Eldar.
I think they wanted to show like numbers, I guess, and for that big robot, I think they wanted to show how good the big robot is. So he just like
that strategy is boring. So big robot fires rockets and it's cool.
But actually, I mean, Dawn of War Retribution was a good version of that, because it was like Dawn of War 2's ability-based heroes plus a bunch of backup units, which is what Dawn of War 3 is doing. It's interesting that they haven't really referenced that in their promotion of it. They're trying to explain, like, it's like Dawn of War 2, but mixed with a load of the units you can also build. I'm like, yeah, you did that. It was great. But I guess no one played it.
You were drawn to Warcraft 3 because you wanted to revisit some of the story. Is that right, Pip? Am I misremembering a conversation we had?
I don't remember that conversation, but then again, I don't remember much, and I certainly don't remember the story of Warcraft 3.
Okay.
So I thought,
success.
I think if I can be trusted to tell anything, I think I went back to it just because I had wanted to go back through the earlier games and just sort of actually get a feel for what they were now that I work in the industry, if you see what I mean, now that they're not just things that I sink time into when I'm avoiding university coursework or, you know, so, and I was trying to find out if there was an easy way to start at the very beginning, but Warcraft 3 was just easy because Blizzard actually still sell a version of it. So that just ended up being the thing that I got. But I was kind of annoyed with myself because just after I'd finished buying it, I was cleaning out a drawer and I found my disc copy.
I have a disc copy as well, actually. That you
mentioned. Oh, for God's sake. This is like how I bought Every Day is Like Sunday on iTunes about 3 times because I spelled it differently every time and could never find it in my library. But yeah, so and that's been interesting because I've been playing it and I do not remember anything that has happened so far. So it is like playing an entirely new game, which is interesting. And kind of cool.
It'd be interesting to go back to Warcraft 2. Well, Warcraft 1, I played them all when they came out, and but Warcraft 2 was kind of nuts. I had the giant naked ogres who were just like enormous. They had this very cartoony art style that was kind of unique because Warcraft 1, it was too low res to really have much of a style. They just did their best to depict what they were trying to depict. And then Warcraft 2, they went up hugely in resolution and they sort of had like pixels to play with. And so they developed this very cartoony style. And then Warcraft 3, because it was polygonal, they had to kind of go back to being quite crude. And it was still stylized, but it wasn't so, wasn't as cartoony, I don't think. But also Warcraft 2 introduced boats. And as with many RTSs, they didn't really have a way of doing the scale of boats in any sane way. So like a boat is just the same size as an ogre.
Yeah. And
supposedly has a crew of like many people and stuff. And I just remember that being like mad. I think the ogre mages were in that one too. Or ogre magi, sorry.
A bit like the character Ogre Magi.
Yeah. There may be a connection there. Those are bizarre. And just having like cannons shooting giant naked babies on the ice was hilarious.
Yeah. I think I just sort of, it's weird because I am still just enjoying the game far more than I'm enjoying the story. Like, I don't think I've ever really been that into Blizzard storytelling. Like, it's not really.
I've talked about this before, but.
Done it for me.
The bit where it transitions from the human campaign to the undead campaign is one of the few good story beats in an RTS, I think.
Okay.
Because it's, you keep playing as the same person, and there's like a pretty good justification for why you do the thing that reviles you to everyone, and they all treat you like an outcast.
Okay.
Yeah, then a bit of a round of dad stabbing.
I can't remember, is it, so like the human campaign leads into the undead campaign, it's all one continuous thing, but presumably it doesn't do that for like night elves and orcs, right?
No, because they're not as married. Arthur's No, it doesn't.
And then his cousin.
You over.
It like, takes you,
the prologue is you play as those guys. You know, the green ones. The
Orcs.
Faces. Yes. And then, like, Thrall gets on a boat and then it's suddenly like, and now human time. And yeah. It's just like, oh,
it gets,
must
it
we?
It takes the story of the humans and the undead up to a certain point and then goes back to the Orcs doing their thing.
Right.
And that leads you to the Night Elves doing their thing. And then everyone gets together for a big party.
So I played the end of the prologue twice just because I was just like, but I wanted to play more of the orc story. Like, why am I on humans now? This is annoying.
Because this is also how Dawn of War 3 is going to work, isn't it? It switches you between characters you don't choose who to play as, which has some advantages, but...
I think I was so annoyed with playing as the humans at one point that I just killed Arthas. And it's just like, mate, I've got an altar of storms, you'll be fine. Just stop being annoying for a while.
You can't. Stuck that way.
They just stood him in the middle of an undead base. It's just like, well.
They did, I mean, to be fair, they sort of took that approach with StarCraft 2 as well, in that only that was over the course of entire games. So, you know, an entire human game, then an entire Zerg game, then an entire Protoss game. Although, at least Legacy of the Void has that absurd epilogue, which is a mini campaign in itself that happens after you've finished the main campaign, where you play as all three. And that ends this whole story. Huh. And yeah. Which is Blizzard. They really, really commit to telling those stories through the medium of clicking little men.
The thing is, though, listening to somebody talk about Warcraft or going through the wikis and stuff, it's like when I try and tell people about what's happening in Holby City at any point. You know, you just be like, oh, and then so-and-so, whose aunt is like this weirdo who doesn't like the new daughter-in-law, and the new daughter-in-law is, you know, and all of that.
That's kind
of
campaign,
Lich King.
Right?
Well, there's like a plot where like the aunt of a guy who works on the...
We should actually try and guess. Holby or Warcraft?
There are very few aunts in gaming, I think. You don't get aunts a lot in gaming.
No.
There was just a really awkward scene about a birthday party, and it only really made sense if you remembered that the wife had, like, I think her dad was an escaped Nazi war criminal, and her husband's parents were Jewish, so like there was a really awkward party like moment where they weren't invited that was, you know, only really made sense if you knew all of that weird backstory.
If you'd read the whole British kind of
hobby lore,
yeah. But like, and so I guess it's more like a soap opera to people, but for me it's just like I still can't quite find a hook into it, and it's more just I just want to make peons do my bidding, really.
Fair.
How about you, John?
I have played something new, but I'm going to be annoying and briefly talk about Fallout 4 again.
Fair enough.
Go for it.
We previously discussed how there are templates to Fallout or Bethesda expansions.
Yeah.
But we have to add a new one, and that is Weird Curiosity. Because they just put out a new one called Contraptions, and it's a bunch of junk for the settlement construction system. And it's... stuff like ball runs and conveyor belts and fabricating machines and triggers and junk cannons and like logic switches and stuff like that. And the concept behind it is that you will take all this crap and build like Rube Goldberg machines or like Infinity Factory, like factory layouts and stuff.
It feels like the Banjo-Kazooie nuts and bolts of Fallout 4.
Yeah, I think its only purpose and the only thing it will achieve is one incredible YouTube video.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to play with this stuff. There's about 100 new things in total, and down to really like complex, like I talked about logic gates, these are like and or operators and stuff like that. And it's all buried in the world's worst interface.
I remember the settlement interface was already pretty bad. There was a bunch of weird button choices that where the thing I kept wanting to press would cancel me out of the menu. Or
yeah, well, there's now about 300 items buried in there, and the only way you can see those is on a row of like 1x10 at the very bottom of your screen. So you're endlessly sorting through and going backwards.
Oh my god!
Would this not come into the category? Were it not an official thing of really technically impressive mod that you're not sure why someone made.
That's the only credit I can give Bethesda, in that the mod community probably can't and definitely wouldn't have ever made something like this. So they are doing something useful as DLC.
Yeah.
But I think in total there's going to be two people who care about this, and one of them is the person who worked at Bethesda who actually made the thing.
And the other is the creator of that YouTube video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to do one where you can build your own vault, right?
Yeah, that's the next one.
How does that work? I mean, like, are you narratively...
Does that make any sense?
Actually building the vault after the nuclear apocalypse? It feels like defeating the point of the vault.
You're closing the vault door after the horses
after the nuclear horses exploded, yeah. But yeah, like, if people can do that, why are they building all this other shit? Why are they building the shacks?
As somebody who sat in the Bethesda presentation at E3 where they announced all of this crafting system nonsense and sighed and was generally the opposite of anybody who was whooping, because I really hate crafting, I think that the only thing that would have enticed me in is if they'd added DLC that made it marble run. You know, like, if you could just, as part of your settlement, have an amazing marble run. Because
now you can, apparently.
The joy of it, the joy of marble run as opposed to Rube Goldberg, is that they're just, like, lots of simple pieces that you can slot together and you know what they are and you can just sort of play with it, you know? I think that the problem with the crafting system that John's described is just that there's too many bits, you know? There's, like, so many different things, and I quite like the idea of, you know, it's like when they started adding all the other bits to Lego and I got less interested. It was just like, well, if you give me everything that I could possibly want for a thing, then I've got no need to improvise or to try and do anything slightly weird or... I don't know, it just feels a bit like, oh, you've just handed me everything, I guess.
Yeah, if you're not the kind of person who is excited by the prospect that you can now remove all your messy cables from your Fallout settlement and replace them with geometric conduits on the ground, this probably isn't for you.
That does sound pretty good, actually. I had mixed feelings about cables. And I say that as somebody who has feelings about cables.
But the main thing I've been playing is a game called Dex, which is Deus Ex meets Metroid.
Huh. Okay.
It's a, like Metroid, it's a side-on 2D thing set in a cyberpunk world where you are somewhat similar to a Deus Ex protagonist in that you are going adventuring and upgrading... augmentations and skills, you're fighting and sneaking and exploring and like dodging through environmental hazards and so on.
Is this Dex as in DEX?
DEX, yeah.
So not the plural of deck?
No, but there's probable crossover there because it's very, very sort of classic cyberpunk with hackers and their decks and so on.
Right.
Also, DEX is a bit like Deus Ex, but shorter. Right,
which is even more relevant, but yeah, it's not got the kind of flair or twist that something like Deus Ex or Shadowrun has. It's very sort of classic cyberpunk to the point where you play a blue-haired techno girl who is being chased out of a normal life by the mega corporations and has to go underground into the city and work out what's going on with some friendly hackers and so on. But it's for like a Metroid game, it's got a really classic RPG structure where you have the kind of main thread of the story missions going through, but you've also got loads of side missions where you can go off and do odd jobs for people and get money and equipment and upgrade yourself and give yourself better legs so you can jump higher, which is the best augmentation in any game, mm-hmm. apart from maybe carrying bigger boxes.
Yeah, those the two. Can you do that in Dex, carry bigger boxes?
You can't, unfortunately. But it's got a little bit of that Deus Ex gameplay. Like, one of the bigger missions I did recently was infiltrating the warehouses on the docks, and I had a choice of either just running in guns blazing or... like going underneath and doing some environmental puzzles and then popping up and hacking the security system and then silently taking down some guards and so on. Huh. And then nicking all the technology and running off back to my chop shop or whatever.
What do you have, if you're doing like a stealthy takedown on a guard, do you have like special tools for that?
You literally have push button to take down guards. But it's like a stealth challenge. You have to get behind them.
Yeah.
And with kind of a janky stealth system, that's a bit of a challenge. But yeah, like the jankiness covers most of the systems in this. It was kickstarted. I wasn't aware of it when it first kickstarted. I don't know how well it did. But a lot of the stuff is just functional to good sort of level. But it all comes together as a bit more of the sum of its parts. But like the art is all hand-drawn, frame-by-frame stuff. And it's okay, but it doesn't really have like flair or like the vision of like Deus Ex had. JJB, Jonathan Jack
Belletet
behind it, Mr. Triangle Man.
Golden Triangles.
Who gave it everything, a layer of fairy dust and so on, but they either didn't have the funds or like the vision for that. So it's very reasonably well executed art, and the content is extremely sort of default cyberpunk, so it's all grimy streets and noodle bars and yeah, stuff like that. And that kind of carries over into the writing as well. There's lots of bad hacker talk, and there's strong indications that you might be a chosen one of some point.
Oh god!
And
I hate to be chosen.
There's wacky hackers who make terrible jokes and dodgy to reasonable voice acting. But yeah, like I said, all these kind of good-ish elements come together and kind of mesh and collide into something that's actually quite fun to play. And I'm kind of looking forward to getting back to it. And I've got a mission to go and reactivate an old, like, dormant chemical factory that's lying under the sewers, because obviously there are sewers. but that's kind of intriguing. And, yeah.
Cool.
That's cool. I think I have seen something of it now that you mention it. What you're saying, the protagonist sounded familiar, but I didn't have it on my radar as like a Deus Ex-y thing. I thought it was like a hardcore platformer, I think.
No, it's got, there are a few places where you do have choices.
Nice.
Quite nice. I think it's on GOG and Steam, but it's a little bit pricey. So maybe look out for it in the summer sale, which is surely coming soon.
What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing two things. One of which I did not get on with that well. So I was really excited about Mirror's Edge Catalyst. And I don't know what my verdict on it is yet, but I'll explain why I don't know. which is, I played it like pretty soon after launch. I was very excited. I tried to buy it like, annoyingly came out like 2.5 days later in the UK. So when I thought it was out, I had to wait. And I had it all preloaded and stuff. I started up Origin with great reluctance and bought it there for like £50 or however much it costs. I was very excited to get into it. I knew the beginning was going to be a bit crap because it's going to be story stuff, and I didn't have high hopes for the story stuff in the first place from what they'd shown in trailers, and then also no one said the story stuff was good in reviews. Everyone pretty much said it was just dry and boring. And it is. it's reasonably smooth, the beginning, in terms of like, you know, it's not frustrating or annoying for a while. But then it just never stops being a tutorial. Or obviously it eventually stops being a tutorial, but it hasn't stopped for me, and I've played it for hours now. And after like the initial bit that should have been just the only tutorial, and just before you get let out into the open world, there's like a combat tutorial, and it needs one because the combat is revised, although according to most of the reviews, not to any great effect. And now it's all about something that sounds promising, which is like you kick people basically in a direction. So you can run straight towards them and kick them, but then it's usually better to kind of like start strafing right as you kick them, and then that'll kick them right. And if there's two of them, you can kick one into the other, and it does a completely unrealistic amount of damage for them to touch each other anyway. They just like hate touching each other. As soon as like one touches the other, they lose loads of health.
They get a lot of cooties.
And that's fine. That seems like the basis of a good system, because basically I want to kick people off roofs, and anything you can do to help me do that, I'm up for it. But it's designed in the most obnoxiously irritating way. So that you're just learning to do combat moves, but they're against holograms. And actually, one thing that's maddening about every part of the everything that's part of the tutorial, including once you're out in the open world, is that they keep putting ghosts in front of you. Like, fucking ghosts. Ghosts are never good in games. I've never enjoyed ghosts
as in,
existing.
As in, like, racing
but,
game...
Yes, in this case, racing game ghosts. But not...
Sorry, I thought you meant ghosts.
but they are, like... They explain them as, like, actually part of the narrative. Like, oh, you may see echoes of other runners running around, and we have an explanation for this, which is a mistake. But then also, it's just fucking maddening to, like, every cool thing you can do in Mirror's Edge, if you see someone else doing it right in front of you, like, two steps in front of you, so all you can see is their ass as they do the thing, and then you just have to do exactly what they did. It just robs it of any joy it could possibly have had. So every moment of that is suffering.
Can't you switch off, or is it just impossible?
Nope. It's not like a feature of the full game, I think. Like, eventually one day in, you know, 2028, when I get through the tutorial, this will stop happening. But the tutorial just, like, even once you're out in the open world, individual missions have this as well to, like, make sure you understand everything.
Great.
But, so you see, like, the hologram go off and do the kick, and then you do the kick. And if you do the kick wrong, they have to make sure you understand every combat move, and there's, like, eight of them or something. And so if you do the kick wrong, they set you back just to immediately before you did the kick. So, like, you lose literally a second of progress. That's fine. And then they start to intersperse platforming sections with the kicks. And sometimes that's necessary because it's like, here's how you kick from a wall run, and then you've got to do that right. And if you don't, then they set you back to just before the wall run. But then there's, like, long jumps and big drops. And if the last one of those is just... I kept failing it because... not because of execution, but I just didn't know what I was supposed to do. There's this really big gap, and there's a wall to your right, and so I'm thinking wall run on that, but the wall kind of juts out, and every time I try and wall run off, I just fall down, and that's not a fatal drop, but then when you climb back up, there's nothing else to do except, like, try and make the jump, and eventually I fall off and die. And if you die, even though they can reset you to the last combat move you did, they reset you to all the way to the start of the entire combat tutorial, so you have to do every combat move tutorial all over again from the start. And this is, like, the last one, so you have to do all eight before that and all of the platforming bits in between. And they know how to reset you. Like, they've saved your progress each time on each of these things, and they've just, like, decided to punitively make you repeat all combat moves because you fucked up a piece of platforming. Like, there's no way to screw up the combat in a way that you die, because they're literally holograms. They can't fight back. So you can't die from combat. So if you die, they know you died from platforming, and they've decided to force you to repeat all combat tutorials as penalty for that. And it's just fucking maddening. I rage quit, like, twice from that.
How are you supposed to do it in case listeners are like, oh, I'm stuck there too?
You do have to wall run. It's just that, like, about half the time it just drops you.
Great.
And it's got that weird sort of, like, you know how in games anything with, like, fine detail on it can't be sort of run on or climbed on or anything because the mesh would be too complicated. It has a bit of fine detail, like, nearer you, but then if you kind of get around that, you can still wall run on it. It's just awkward and weird. And then there's a tutorial for here's how to... So that's the conversation with, like, holograms, and it's explicitly training. They're asking you to practice. Then you go out in the world and they say, okay, now we need you to get these, like, I don't know, devices, and then you've got to deliver them somewhere. And the delivery mission, they say, okay, you're on time limit here. You've got to get them. You can't stop to, like, fight these guards. You've just got to run past them. And here's how to hit someone and run past them. And, okay, so, like, zip line down, and I jump off the zip line and hit the first guard with, like, you have to do a light attack to make sure you just hit them and move on rather than stopping to fight. And then the next guard is just, like, way over to my right, and I don't need to hit him at all, so I just run straight past him. And then it fails me, makes me restart the mission, because I didn't stop to hit him. Like, the point of this mission is to teach you how to not stop and fight, and if you don't stop and fight every guard, they fail you. You have to stop and fight them, but then fight them in the light way that allows you to carry on.
Don't fight them only a bit.
Oh, come on! Sorry?
We're against the clock here, Faith. Yeah. You have to slightly fight everybody.
It's a weird clock. That's how it works.
We're up against the weird clock this time.
This is incredibly wanky, but have you ever achieved flow? Have you ever strung, like, several cool moves together and, like, felt the speed and the improvisation and stuff?
Okay, so yes to the first question and no to the first question and yes to the second one. I've done that, but it didn't feel like flow. It's just, like, do the thing that they tell you to do and do the thing that the ghost fucking did just before you. So there's no sense of you sort of, like, flow is you're reacting to things, and each sort of stimulus, you know what to do about it, and it's just interesting enough for you to care about it. And this is like, just do what the ghost did. And I know that will end eventually, but it's just been going on for so long. I'm right on the open world, and I was loving that for a minute, and then every individual mission has just been bullshit.
A shame.
Yep. But Overwatch is still great.
Good wall running.
Yeah. Although I don't play Lucio much. I think last time we talked about it, I was playing D.Va and Hanzo and someone else. Widowmaker, I think. And I hadn't played Tracer. I'd vaguely tried her once against AI, but I was mostly playing on gamepad, so I didn't want to play as her because she needs to turn around really quickly sometimes. And then eventually I did try her with mouse and keyboard and just completely rediscovered the game. Just had a moment of oh my God, I can't believe you can do this. This is amazing. It felt like playing the spy for the first time in TF2, in that sense of discovering... it feels like cheating. I shouldn't be allowed to do this. No one else can do this. Why am I allowed to do this? Oh my God, I've killed six of them. And in particular, it actually feels like the Dead Ringer spy in TF2, because this is a gadget that they added quite far into TF2's lifespan, where usually the spy is about hiding from enemies and then ambushing them with your knife and stabbing them all before they know what's happening. And then once they know what's happening, you're either going to die, or if you killed enough of them, you might escape. And then the Dead Ringer was a thing where when you have it equipped, as soon as an enemy shoots you, it ejects a ragdoll from you as if you've died and cloaks you so that they can't tell you're still alive. So in theming, it's supposed to be a sort of deception device. But of course, everyone knows it exists, so everyone knows that when you kill a spy, you got to keep shooting. And so to defend against that, it also just protects you from 90% of damage. So it had this great feeling of instead of being a thing where you're trying to avoid detection or convince them that you're not there, you're like, I know you know I'm here, and you just can't touch me. I'm just fucking invincible. And that's what Tracer feels like, because she's not invincible, she's incredibly weak, but she just has so many ways of getting out of situations that should kill her. When you're cornered, when you know you're going to die, both of your abilities are just designed to get you out of that. And so you have these amazing chains of just, you go behind enemy lines using your rapid series of teleports. And that's it's an interesting thing because it's not really stealth, but sometimes it works as stealth, not because no one sees you, because they just kind of glimpse you and then they're just like, oh, I don't know where the fuck she went. I can't afford to go hunting her. It's really easy to get behind enemy lines, and then you attack someone, and if you find someone isolated, obviously you can almost always take them out because your pistols are really good close range. And then inevitably I fuck up and I attack the wrong thing, or I attack I'm trying to sneak up on an engineer in his turret, and his turret sees me, and then he realizes that I must be there, and they're both attacking me, and then another guy shows up. And then you can either just blink away with your teleports, or if you really fuck it up, then you can rewind time, and you go back to where you were 3 seconds ago with the same health as then. And chaining those two things together just gives you so many ways out of things, and the teleport recharges really quickly, and the rewind doesn't recharge that slowly. It's not your ultima or anything, so you can use it quite a lot. And I was just getting into situations where just fuck up, get out of it, try again, eventually kill that person, then fuck up again, and then get out of it. And then I blink away from somebody to try and get away from them, and then realize I just teleported into the abyss. Now I'm going to die. And then I realize, oh no, I can rewind time, so fuck you.
And just fuck you, back. Abyss.
Yeah, exactly. Screw the abyss and my own incompetence. And then stuff like someone catches you and it's a stronger class than you in the particular situation you're in, so you run away from them. And then while you're running away from them, you realize, I can just rewind now, and then I'm behind them. And now it's not a bad situation, and I've won. And yeah, it's awesome. And that's although I don't want to play things with mouse and keyboard because of RSI, I have so much more fun playing as Tracer, and I'm also so much more effective as Tracer than any other class that it's kind of... I just have to play as Tracer at almost any opportunity.
Killing Tracer is uniquely rewarding. It really is.
I find that even as Tracer, actually. If there's an enemy Tracer, as with spies, I think there's an instant rivalry. And it feels like the ultimate achievement is to kill the enemy Tracer.
Mm. The two best ways of killing Tracer, in terms of feeling rather than, effectiveness, the most effective way is McCree. Because you stun her, she's dead.
Yeah, I get stunned a lot.
There's nothing she can do. Second most satisfying is Hanzo headshots, when you anticipate where she's going to either blink to or recall to, because that's like a really good fuck you. The most satisfying is Reinhardt's hammer, because she can teleport through Reinhardt's like hollow shield to like attack the back line and then teleport back out in front of him where he can't really get at her. But if you anticipate that's what she's going to do, she does die in like one good hammer blow, particularly if she's already taken a bit of damage. So you can just sort of turn at the moment she does it and swing, and there's a great there's a great kind of kinetic thwack to like clotheslining someone with a gigantic rocket hammer as they think they're being clever. It feels good. It's good.
I've also just been liking the game generally a lot more because I've been playing it differently. And it, I feel like it's a way we didn't really play TF too much, where we actually form a party and play as a group. And it's also like it puts a lot more emphasis on playing a complete game. Like if you leave before the end of a game more than a couple of times, it gives you a warning saying repeatedly leaving before the game is over will incur a penalty. And I was, first time I got that, I was like, what? Because I'm just used to leaving. Most of the time it's just because I need to be somewhere and I've got to stop playing now. But sometimes also I'll just like, you play one round and you get completely crushed, you play the next round and you get completely crushed, and then you're like, oh, I just don't want to play this. I want to find a new group. And the penalty is A, not triggered unless you've left like 90% of your last 10 games or something. And B, all it does is just stop you from gaining XP until that's not true anymore, until you haven't left 90% of your last 10 games. So just play a few more and don't leave, and then it's fine. And all it does is like, oh no, don't get a loot box for a bit longer. So it's actually really mild. But just that kind of mindset of like, it's about playing a whole game. And if you join a friend mid-match, you almost never get into the match. You just have to watch the whole match, and then you play the next match that you can with them. So usually if you're going to play with friends, it's kind of a thing where you have to organize it just a little bit. You just have to, it's much better if you all start playing at the same time, which is a little bit more hassle, but it does mean that the way we end up playing is just more satisfying. We just sort of play, even if it's just like one other person, just going through like three or four games together and seeing it all the way through. And even if you lose, it's not as bad if you're playing with friends. And it feels, TF2 never even really had like a party system or anything like that. If you want to play with friends, you just have to like meet up on a particular server, basically. You can just right-click a friend and join them in game. But again, you're joining in the middle of a thing and it will be like a 24-player thing, and it's just kind of much more chaotic and you're not as invested in the actual experience. Whereas Overwatch is way more controlled and it's always 6v6 and you always have to start at the start and you always have to play it through to the end. And that ends up working better, I think.
This is so weird to me because I'm so used to games that penalize you massively for leaving. Like, you know, you had to go and answer the phone because your sister was having a baby. Oh, well, you're in low prio now, Buster. You're just like, oh, for goodness sake. Or like, but the thing that I find weird about Overwatch in that respect, actually, like, it never occurred to me that I would be allowed to leave a game without it incurring
I don't even do that in other multiplayer games where it's fine anymore.
The thing that bothers me about Overwatch is that it is really stingy with the amount of time it gives you to do something. So like, if somebody invites you to the party, you've got like half a second to say you accept. Otherwise, it's just that, well, I guess you just didn't want to play enough.
And also, if you're playing on a gamepad like me, it says press Y to accept. And you press Y on the gamepad and nothing happens. It means Y on the keyboard.
Oh, for God's sake, that's so stupid.
Wifey yes, not wifey yellow.
But like, and there's the other thing that it does, which is, so for example, if you're waiting or like you're waiting for other people to do something and you haven't realized that a match has started yet, like if you're alt-tabbed or if you're just staring out of the window, then it's just like, oh well, you've been ditched for inactivity, and you're just like, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah,
like,
it's inactivity timeout is very, very quick.
It's the game kind of, it feels like the game is having an active hissy fit that you might be tabbed out or value something else for 5 seconds. It's like this really
If you
needy...
like real life so much, why don't you marry it?
it's like when like a toddler wants your attention, your undivided like, well, look, I'm doing the jump. You're not looking. For God's sake.
It's funny because it sort of wins and loses in the same way, because you find a match so quickly that if someone needs a break, between games. It's usually better just to like wait a minute rather than queue straight away. However, if you get timed out when you're playing with your friends, you then kind of have to wait until their game is done before you get to play, because it will fill the spot you are in like instantly. Because it's not just, you know, you're not looking. It's, well, if you don't want it, this guy can have it. Don't care if you're not friends with him. He's in your team now. You're playing with him.
It's just, like I feel like that could do with a slight rebalancing just to sort of make it a bit more forgiving, especially when someone's just like invited you to a party, because surely it's just like, well, they'll wait, and if they don't, then they'll start queuing, you know, like why is it on the game to decide?
Yeah, and if you're like, if you're a team of like four or five or six, then the only person it's hurt, people it's hurting, is your friends, and it's up, should be up to them whether they are okay with that. You know, they're at a disadvantage when you're idling, but it's not hurting the enemy teams.
Or like if you're not in the group or you haven't accepted and they start queuing, then fine. But it's just like, it just really bothers me that the game is imposing that kind of, I must press the thing, I can't finish the thing I was doing.
So I didn't know any of this, and I was playing with some friends, and I went to get a drink, and when I came back, I'd been kicked out of the game, I'd been kicked out of the group, and Discord had crashed. I just left completely alone on my desktop.
No like, friends for you.
Wow. Sorry I took 1 minute rather than 30 seconds.
Yeah. Or like if you, if you time out while... Like, there's been a couple of times where I can't remember the exact sequence of events that have happened, but we've ended up queuing and everyone thought that they were queuing. But then you boot into a game and you realise someone is no longer in the group.
You've left someone at the service station.
Basically, it's just like, oh God, did we have everyone?
Who's this guy? This is extra child we've put in the car.
The buddy system has failed us. But yeah, so...
I guess it's the plot of a new Home Alone movie for sure. Should we do questions?
Sure. Okay. Immediately.
What?
Oh. Questions.
Yes.
Tony writes, hello, Crit and Crowbar. Recently, TinyBuild took time to explain how key reseller G2A sold $450,000 of their games and didn't pay them any money, and provides a link to a Gama Sutra article that we'll link in the show notes. This got me thinking about how I buy games. I don't use G2A, but I do use similarly unauthorized sellers like CD Keys to get games or even Steam credit for cheap. I assume this is rather more grey area of regional price differences, but the truth is, I just don't know where the keys come from, and I hadn't really thought about it until now. My question is this, do we need to rethink how we buy games from a moral perspective, or is this simply an economic effect of a system tilted by bundles, regions, and customers trained to wait for sales? Thanks to the pod, I wishlist you all. Tony, who's standard man on Discord.
Yeah, I saw that article too, and it's pretty remarkable, the scale of the thing. The stat was, the $450,000 was how much those keys would have been worth if they were sold at retail price, which is sort of a stretch if you want to call that like lost revenue or anything. G2A sold them at like a bit less than half that, so they made about $200,000. And TinyBuild contacted them and said like, they're interested in like working with G2A at one point. They thought they'd set up like a marketplace with them and sell some keys through them. But then they were trying to find out like how many of our keys have we already sold, and then that's when they got the stat, and they said, oh, will we get any compensation for this? And they said no, and they said that these will be keys that your business partners have sold through G2A. Like, they basically said your business partners are kind of screwing you over, and if you think that they're fraudulent, which TinyBuild do, then we can look into that, but only if you work with us, only if you, like, you know, collaborate with us as business partners and set up a store on G2A, and you'll have to send us all the keys that you know are fraudulent, which, of course, you can't ever really know. And that was basically it. But TinyBuild used to run their own store, and they stopped when, basically, they had thousands of orders that would then immediately get chargebacked, meaning they don't get any money for it, and they've given out the keys already, and then those keys would pop up on G2A right afterwards and be sold for money. And basically, it's people get, they don't do it with their own cards, they get like credit card details from the bad internet. I forget what its official name is.
Naughty net,
yeah. And then quickly use them to buy loads and loads of keys, and then keep the keys. The people whose cards have been stolen obviously didn't decline the charges, and then the keys get sold on. it's obviously that is just fraud. That's illegal. And the question of like, should it be allowed? No, that shouldn't be allowed, obviously. But then the question of like, people who buy, if someone buys things in bundles and they have these Steam keys for games that they don't want or they already have, and they sell those keys on, that is like against the terms of service of the bundle, in certainly for Humble Bundle. I don't know about others. And so it's like, again, it's not legal to do that. But then, like, from a consumer's perspective, do they have to feel morally bad for buying keys like that? And on that point, I think, nah. Like, it does, if you want to be really conscientious, then, you know, yeah, none of your money is going to the developer when you do that, so bear that in mind. But on some level, I feel like when you sell a game at one price and somebody does some trick such that it ends up being sold at the higher price instead, it's just moving the numbers around. Like, it's the fact, it's not sort of like this great moral good that if you bought Gunpoint when it was $1.50, which is the lowest it's been, although it wasn't a Humble Bundle as well, if you bought it at $1.50, that's not because it was morally right to buy it at $1.50 at that point, and then when it's back up to $10, it's morally wrong to buy it for $1.50 or anything. So the fact that somebody can undercut us by buying them cheap and then selling them on at slightly more than that doesn't really give me any moral outrage. But the thing where they just legitimately steal the keys is obviously bullshit.
I think it's on the consumer as well. There's a lot of analogues with music. You can go to sites online and buy heavily discounted music per track or whatever, and it's obviously stolen, and it's obviously going to a Russian's bank account. And I think it's worse than theft, because you're paying a token amount to reduce your guilt.
Yeah.
So you know, none of the money is going to the creator. Money is going to someone who utterly is undeserving of it, and you get to maintain your high road a little bit.
It's a bargain rather than a rip-off.
Yeah. I guess one point to make about these key resellers is that, just from a practical point of view, you might not want to buy them that way, because if the developer does know they've been resold that way and the product fraud, they can just cancel the keys. Like, if you have it on Steam, we can just take the game away from you if we know that it's fraudulent. I guess the case I'm thinking of is like, if, you know, it's a bit like secondhand games, and the terms of service are set up so that you can't do that. You're not allowed to resell a key that you own from a digital store place in, I think, every case. But from my perspective, if somebody buys Gunpoint at one price and then doesn't play it at all and sells it on a different price, that's like secondhand games, only it's like not as bad as secondhand games because they didn't even play it. Like, it's not like they got the value out of it and then also sold it on. It's they didn't even want to play it. For some reason, it wasn't something that they wanted. So I don't feel like I've lost anything hugely there. They bought it. If they bought it at a price that I offered at that time, then it's just another copy got out in the wild for that price, which is what I was offering.
I think that there is a responsibility on people that they don't often take up in terms of responsible consumption. And it's something that, so obviously when we're talking about key resellers and fraud and associated issues and piracy and things, it ties into so many sort of complicated other digital rights discussions that are going on. But in terms of just what you as somebody who buys things or browses or goes to particular websites, I think that there is an onus on you to at least think about why you're doing it or the behaviours that you're encouraging by doing so. Like, a few years ago, I made a conscious effort to not engage with clickbait stuff, like terrible advertising practices or, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, no matter how much I want to click on that stuff, like, it feels like engaging with it is only leading to a worsening internet. Yeah. And a worsening culture of attention hogging and things like that. And with, because I still keep up with celebrity news and things, but there are sites that I won't visit and I have particular criteria for that, and there are particular sort of, even just sort of from the celebrity photo streams that you can buy things from if you have subscriptions for editorial purposes, like some people use the ones of people leaving doctor's offices or like with their kids and stuff like that. And to me, that's a marker that that's not a site that I'm happy visiting, or that is responsible with the access that they have. And so I think the same thing applies when I go to a retail store to buy something. If I don't know where that stuff has come from, and you know, like, I think people have, if they stop for a moment, there's a pretty good understanding that that did not, that certain, like, levels of discount did not come about with the developer or the publisher being happy with that. So I think it's then on you to make a conscious choice as to whether you want to support that business practice or whether you want to dig into it a bit further. And then I guess at least if you do continue with the purchase, then you have your own reasons and you know why you're doing it. I think that there's an awful lot of just sort of sloppy, you know, sort of things that happen because people just aren't keeping an eye on their own behavior or thinking. Just because it's the path of least resistance and cheapness. Sorry.
The price of the games is a huge concern here, though. If games are overpriced and people have been trained to wait for sales and discounts, then the industry isn't helping.
But that's a thing that you can then be aware of, and you know why you're doing things a certain way, and you can sort of like keep an eye out for other sites that are doing it differently, or, you know, developers that are offering things differently. But I think it's more, for me, the way that oftentimes it seems like people aren't interrogating their own actions or keeping an eye on why they might be doing things.
Sure. I think this makes, in the case of GTOA, if I didn't know that this sort of thing was happening, I wouldn't necessarily from the surface thing see the difference between a GTOA discount and a completely developer authorized discount on Steam. I understand completely that there's an onus on people to maybe be a bit more responsible with how they use services like this, but I think in this case it's actually quite hard to tell what's fair and what isn't, or what's developer approved and what isn't.
I think that's fair, but I think if you have an inkling that something might be off, it's on you to investigate it. I'm not saying that, you know, if you genuinely didn't know, then oh my god, you're like the worst person. It's about, you know, knowing what you're comfortable with and just sort of being a bit more active in how you behave, you know, like your choices.
John writes, "Dear CNC," and then in quotes, "time for long message, but treasure waits ahead." "I've recently been playing through some of the Soulsborne games, and they made me think a lot about death. As a video game mechanic, I mean, not in a morbid way. I noticed how often death within games ruined what I was enjoying most about them, which was the sense of exploring the incredible areas created in these games, picking up slivers of plot and hints about the world, encountering new challenges and working out how to overcome them, the sense of always anticipating danger and excitement while moving towards an unknown goal. All of this brought abruptly to a halt by the death of my character, deserved or otherwise. Developers and gamers alike talk about wanting to create or experience a sense of immersion in a video game world, but software and hardware problems aside, what could be more jarringly immersion-breaking than the death of your character? Mysteriously to be reincarnated at some pre-designated spot, lore explanations for this notwithstanding. Especially when this then means retracing your steps through areas and challenges seen moments ago, except now with some of the newness and wonder stripped away. This contempt due to familiarity increasing exponentially, the more times you have to retread the same paths and actions, one of the many problems with boss fights, in which you will always inevitably die and retry multiple times, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, to get to the point, it made me think about a solution which is almost certainly impossible to implement, but interesting to consider. What if there was a way that your character's life could be threatened, in danger, etc., but never actually taken? But, and here's the twist, without the player ever realizing that they couldn't die. Imagine if such a trick could be pulled off so that the player would have all the same feelings of dread and anticipation of trying to survive perceived threats, but always get through it somehow, even by the skin of their teeth, potentially creating a fantastic feeling of a single adventure with a great flow to it, more like a story or film than a fragmented game experience. Evidently, there are many problems with the idea, such as, is it even possible without drugging or hypnotizing the player in some way? but I'd be interested to hear what you think, how it could be attempted, if you think it could be done, and allowing that it could, whether it would be a good thing. Also, which games deal with death mechanic well or in innovative ways without compromising the core player experience? Reeks of question, therefore provide answer, he puts in brackets, please. Thanks for the great pod.
I think it's interesting that he came to this conclusion or realization while playing Dark Souls. He says he doesn't like, he feels like he loses
immersion.
The little bits of story and immersion, and he says he much prefers just adventuring through it and getting those little snippets of lore and level design and stuff like that. But the point of Dark Souls is the only reason you get those tiny little details is because this is your 10th time through.
Yeah. And you pick up a little bit more every time you go through. And so I get where he's coming from. And I think there's a little bit of the kind of design unicorn to his suggestion, which is that you can create a almost death system that is, that the player still believes is a genuine threat.
Yeah. I agree with, I don't know about Dark Souls games, but I agree with his observation in general, like death is overused in games. That sounds ridiculous, but like I agree with him that it basically in many games, maybe not Dark Souls, but a lot of games are designed around this one narrative thrust, and it needs to continue, and if you stop it and repeat a bit of it, it just sucks. Like, you know, repeating a bit in Call of Duty is just garbage, and lots of games are like that. And the reason there's death is in there is because they just haven't thought of a way around it, basically. In terms of like approaches that do work, I really love games where you can rewind time, and it really does fix this problem. Even though you are still dying, and then we go back and say you didn't die, if it's continuous, if it's like holding a button and then you just see things go in reverse, it doesn't feel as bullshit, and it doesn't break immersion in the same way. It feels like you're still the same person. It still feels like you're still playing the same story, and we just undid like one little thing. I get like it's the difference between like if you're writing an article in Word or something and you type the wrong word, if you just like backspace a couple of times, then it doesn't feel like you started a new article. Whereas if you went to file open and opened an older version of the article, that feels like starting a different article, and your kind of thread is lost to some extent. So I think rewind is a really good way of doing it. I also really love my personal like favorite solution in games is games that have like a really broad failure spectrum, where you can, there's a way to succeed brilliantly, and there's a way to succeed quite well, and there's a way to succeed all right, and there's a way to succeed just about, and there's a way to kind of nearly fail, and there's a way to kind of fail in one sense but not fail in another sense, and then there's a way to fail in most senses but you actually still got through. And Invisible Ink is great for that. That's like a game where your level of success is totally variable. It's like, do you get everything in the level and get everyone out unharmed? Do you get most things out and still escape? Does somebody take some damage but they're okay? Does somebody get killed? Does somebody do you spend too much money? Do you spend too much equipment? And that means that you can feel like you're on the brink of failure all the time, when actually you're really far away from true failure. Like, you're not going to lose all your dudes on that mission. But you, like Invisible Ink, I think every mission I've ever played of that, I'm always thinking, oh fuck, oh god, oh Jesus. And yet I you know, almost never completely failed. I think on my successful runs, you know, I was probably never close to failure.
A game I was going to bring up in that this question made me think of is Until Dawn, which I should stress I do not think is a good game. This is the kind of like choose your own adventure, would be an FMV game if it wasn't full CGI horror thing that came out PlayStation exclusive, I think, last year. Marsh and I played it through in a couple of sittings. And it's really spectacularly dumb, but you know, you're steering a group of teenagers through like a night in it with a haunted cabin in the woods type sort of traditional slasher flick setup. And the first time you play it, when the threat starts to emerge and there are some fake outs with kind of what is and isn't the real threat, you do have the sense that anyone can die and that a cock up can result in a death at any time. But it is like a branching narrative with really fixed beats. So there are specific ways, there are specific times people can die, and it's not all the time. So the majority, and if those deaths happen, that's permanent. Those characters are gone. There are no like fail states where it's like you died, try this bit. Actually, no, there are. Are there? No, there aren't. There's like there are quick time events that you can fail, and they might make things worse for you, but they don't actively Like, the only times characters can die is when it's okay for the narrative that they can die there. But the problem with this is, which is in some ways, I think, probably the closest you can get to actually implementing the system he wants, which is you feel like you're just scraping through these things. And it's, you know, that's hard for a game with the kind of looks of an action game to pull off. It's much easier for someone like XCOM or Invisible Inc., where you are the kind of disembodied commander looking down at people like disposable game pieces. And it gets somewhere near that. But the problem is that you can't ever stop the spell from being dispelled at some point. And so kind of quickly, you know, obviously once you've played it once, the spell is completely gone. You can't go back through and experience that again because you kind of know, I can't actually die here.
Mm.
Or that character isn't going to die till a thing that happens later and so on. The other thing is that you, like, when characters do die, it feels shocking, but not quite in the right way. And it's because it will find a way of getting you out of any danger. Every time you fuck up, it'll get you out of danger somehow. Because it's not that character's time yet, and the game has decided that, because you've got a couple more scenes and conversations to go with that character. So when you do the thing that you fuck up and they do die, your feeling is, oh my god, I got them killed. It's, oh, I fucked up at the time when I'm allowed to die. Because the rest of the time, you stumble and fall off a cliff and the character's fine. Or you pick yourself up and they get a new bruise that is persistent across the rest of the cutscenes. Or they rip their jeans or something. Like the first time I lost a character in Until Dawn, it was simply because I hadn't, I looked it up later, and it was simply that I hadn't found a object hidden in the environment in a previous level. And because of that, a cutscene played out one way rather than a different way that just meant I got put on a meat hook and there's nothing I could do about it. And even though it's like, yeah, it's shocking the character died then, it didn't feel like it could have ever gone any, you know what I mean? It didn't feel like in the moment that I failed something. It still felt very detached from it, even though, because really, and then the ironic thing is, in order to make me feel attached to those moments, you need to let me die in the other moments as well, at which point you have a death system.
Yeah.
And so I think it is one of those intractable things.
I think Creative Assembly probably thought about this a lot with Alien, where, again, the perfect Alien experience is the aliens almost got you.
It's
constantly just behind you, well, not constantly, just behind you over your shoulder, and you just managed to escape and so on. And their solution to that was clever AI and probably some sort of AI director system as well. And yeah, you get a wide range of stories from this was incredibly effective and it worked almost perfectly to I never saw the alien.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely unsolved.
Actually, I think maybe Isolation is one of the few games that does get it close to right in that it's even if death does happen and you do replay stuff, death's never the same. Like, it's not like you die at a scripted bit and then you replay a section because the dynamic nature of the AI means that it isn't the same section again and again, which is actually one of the reasons the game becomes so unpleasant to play, because you don't have the catharsis of I'm repeating this bit but I know this bit. Like, getting down one corridor worth of medical gurneys and boxes is a different full of terror nightmare every time you do it, which makes it incredibly stressful and means you kind of distance yourself from it. Whereas if it had a more traditional, like, you died, try this bit again system, it would probably be more palatable. So yeah, totally impossible to solve.
I don't tend to think about that stuff too often because it comes up most when I play horror games. Like, I remember, like, having a similar, like, I wonder if there is a way around this thought last time I played. It was a Machine for Pigs, the Amnesia game that Chinese Room made. And it was terrifying to me, to the point where I was, like, having to play it in broad daylight and it was, like, really freaking me out. And then finally I got caught by one of the things in the dark. And then from then on, it was just like, oh, it's fine, you know? And occasionally I actually let myself get caught because it would take you to a particular thing each time. Like, you'd sort of spawn in a cage, like it wouldn't kill you. But and so I was just like, oh, that's actually nearer where I want to be. So I just
be like, oh, fine.
Yeah, basically. So I was kind of like using it to cheat, but like the original experience was kind of terrifying, and I was kind of glad when it stopped being terrifying. But I think that one of the problems with games that isn't there with movies and things is that people will just try and break it. Like, you know, I think...
yeah, you want to find out what the boundaries are and...
Yeah, yeah. So, like, even if I'm not that person, like, even if I would prefer never to have been caught by the thing because I was scared, like, there are going to be loads of other people who are just like, I wonder what happens if...
Yeah, it was the first thing I did.
And then it's just like, oh, I just stand here and they just get close and then snuffle and then wander off, I guess. You know, like, in that specific thing. Like, and then you're just like, oh, well, I guess my fear is done.
When I first played the Tomb Raider reboot at a preview event, the first thing you do in that game is walk across a slippery log between two cliffs. Mm. And the first thing I did was try to walk left off it, and you can't. And
yeah.
I discovered not only am I in no danger, like I can't fall if I let go of the controller, I can't fall if I purposely try to walk off the log, but I can't even go back. Like yeah. It's not even like a two-directional thing. It's a one-directional that you can literally only go forwards or briefly pause in going forwards.
Maybe this is something that VR would be... a bit better for, because people do sort of have that sort of corporeal caution, even if they do want to experiment with stuff like that. Like, if you've seen the YouTube video of the people with the VR headset on trying to walk along a plank that's in a room and everything's fine, but they have what they can see is that they're trying to rescue a cat from the end of a thing that's dangling out over like a massive multi-story drop, and it's quite hard to switch off that fear, even if you logically know that yeah. you could step either side. I mean, I'm kind of like, I'm more the dick in that scenario, because I was playing the Everest VR thing and I just sort of sidestepped off the mountain to see what would happen, and I was like, oh well, I guess I just float now. But like, I think a lot of people were genuinely just scared and their body would was freaking out at the idea of stepping.
That's a good point, actually, because the thing they say about VR is that, like, even once you know it's a simulation, even once you tell yourself this isn't real, you can't shake the vertigo or you can't shake the fear of this. Yeah. And I found that a little bit with Hollow Point, the archery game that I was playing before. Until recently, I'd only got to the bit where you just shoot boxes and the boxes can fire back at you, and it's like, it's still a little bit like alarming when a bullet comes from a box towards your head and you've got to dodge it.
That is alarming.
I finally got to wave 10 where ninjas run at you with swords, and that's stressful. Like, even before it happens, like, they're coming towards you. They're quite slow, actually. Running is a
sauntering
strong word. Yeah. They're waddling. The animation's really bad, actually. And you just got to shoot them with one arrow, and they're quite big targets, but they're coming from both sides. You've got to keep looking back and forth and back and forth. And then, like, the first time you play it, inevitably one of them gets you. And when they get you, it's just fucking horrible. Just like, you want to sort of like crawl out of your skin. It's like, you turn around and there's this thing in your face, like just digging a sword into your neck. And you're like, ah! And I know I'm in no danger. And I, like, that I, you know, I'm not going to die in real life. And in this game, death is just, you restart. There's no kind of like death animation or anything. Or, death is a completely abstract concept. But it's probably true that, like, I probably never shake that. Like, no matter how many times it happens, I'll probably always be scared of that.
I think there's... maybe that's the reason that Isolation is so successful as well, is that, like, they did, in reference to this idea of, like, giving you the sense of death but not ever fully committing to it in order to let you scrape by, it does the opposite of that, and it really commits to killing you when it kills you. And I don't really mean that as a joke. Like, I mean that, like... if they were building this AI system, they could build it so that it had like a margin for error built into it. And I think maybe the easier difficulty settings it does, that it will forgive a certain amount of visibility in order to let you get through the game. But later on, the whole feeling of it doesn't work unless it's really diligent about doing the thing it's threatening to do. Like, it doesn't sort of go, oh, I got you, fade to black. It does the thing where you suddenly like judder and then you look down and there's an alien tail sticking through your chest and then it fades to black, and that's dead cool. But and it gives you this sense of
never, like, playing that in VR.
Yeah, it gives you the sense of really good,
or anything like it.
Like, it gives you the experience of the side of thing, the cinematic side of things that you don't get to experience, which is like what it's like to fail really abruptly. Like, I made a GIF ages ago that when I did an Alien Isolation live stream for PC Gamer, where, like, I think the stream was sort of coming to an end, so I sort of made, I was like, I'm just going to run for it. I'm going to see what happens if I run through this level that also had the sort of nasty androids, the sort of milk white androids that like to strangle you. And I kind of bolted down a corner, and I thought I could hear the alien behind me. And then I ran straight into one of the androids, which went straight into his, like, strangling you animation that you kind of have to wrestle yourself free from. And then I shoved myself away from him and staggered backwards completely seamlessly into the being hoisted into a vent by the alien animation, because I pushed myself back from the android underneath a vent. And then that does take control from you, but only so you look up and see the thing kind of, like, dunk from above and grab you and pull you up into the vent. And it was, like, the most fucked you could possibly be. It was like, oh, well, that's how that story ends. And it felt like a good ending. It felt, you know, even though it's a death and technically you have to restart something, it felt like, okay, well, that's the end of the story. That's the sudden, brutal, you know, mid-season Game of Thrones twist to this is that, yeah, just doomed. Will writes, "Dear Crate, Crate, Crow, Crow, Bar, Bar. I'm a staff director at an opera house, and we just had a premiere. I was watching the show when we got to the bit where there's a video of some of the performers driving in a car in front of various landscapes, when I realised that they were cruising through virtual Madagascar from the first driving segment of Uncharted 4. I'm fairly confident I was the only person apart from the videographer to notice this. What is the oddest slash most incongruous place you've ever found a game or a reference to one? Regards, Will." Well, I think, John, was it you that brought up the amazing example from a couple of years ago now, 2011, 2012?
Yeah, armor footage on ITV News.
Yeah, they accidentally used some footage from armor on the news as a depiction of, was it a helicopter being shot down in Ireland? Something like that? And no, that was a, they, because they'd Googled it or something and just found armor and thought it was real.
There was a thing recently where, I want to say, like, the Russian embassy or something tweeted some news about some weapon sales, and they'd used a, I think some, like, I don't know if it was Humvees or rockets or something, but they used the rocket Humvee from CNC Generals as the image to go with their tweet.
There was, I think there was an instance of the BBC, I might get the details of this wrong, but they did a story about, I think, PMCs or something, like private military companies. I think it was PMCs. And the logo they included in the article was a PMC from Call of Duty, because they just Googled, like, PMC logos. It's always, like, an intern at a news agency Google image searching the thing they need for the story.
Yeah. One of the most incongruous things I ever heard happened at my graduation. I did a games degree at Lincoln. It was the very first year that we'd run it, or they'd run it, rather. And they wanted to make... They obviously wanted to make a big deal about how successful it had been. Me and some friends from the final year made a mod called The Hidden, which had done quite well. And so somehow the lecturer got the dean or whoever at the university to mention this in the graduation ceremony, which was held at the top of a hill in a cathedral. And this ancient man had just walked in a parade holding the ceremonial mace and was on the lectern of the cathedral and said the words, the Half-Life 2 mod, The Hidden Source, is doing very well. And it's words like that should never be spoken in the cathedral. That was great.
That's awesome.
Wow. Mine's a Holby City one. Just stop. There's a doctor called Morven, Dr. Shreve. Well, she's Dr. Digby now, but anyway. And she, like, in one of the first episodes that she's in, she's like a junior doctor being mentored, and her mentor is a guy called Arthur, who she later marries. And I think he quotes Napoleon at her, or so, it's something like that. And she reciprocates with a quote of her own that she knows because she's played a lot of Civ. And it's like, it's the weirdest kind of most, wait, what moment? Because usually sort of Holby doesn't really acknowledge that pop culture exists, if you see what I mean. Like, the conversations that people have tend to be sort of plot related or kind of timeless in that weird way that doesn't reference current events. But, like, yeah, that was just one of those, oh, that's a peculiarly human thing to just sort of say as part of conversation.
Actually, now that you mention TV, House of Cards, the bit where Kevin, or there's that, and then, like, he's had a weird relationship with video games, the whole thing, and then the strangest one for me was he's trying to figure out how to, like, market his new initiative, and he suddenly gets really excited about the iOS store description for Monument Valley, which is a really cool indie game. But he reads out the entire, like, official description of what Monument Valley is and says it's, like, beautiful and it's incredible poetry and, like, why can't we come up with something like this for our policy? And so there's a whole plotline of him promoting his thing based on the Monument Valley store description. Like, this is strange.
Actually, how far are you into The Good Wife?
I think I've watched all but one episodes that are on Netflix. Oops, sorry.
Okay. So if I were to mention a peculiar video games moment in that, you wouldn't be wrong-footed because it's it's before the end of the last season that's on Netflix. I just really don't want to spoil it for you.
Well, there may be listeners that
there will be listeners who are interested as well.
Well, it's been so long that on Netflix, like it's not even the final season that's on TV now. So
skip ahead a minute if you care about Good Wife spoilers.
Okay. Yeah. Well, while Alicia Florrick is waiting for the votes to come in for her, like, bid at the state's attorneyship, I think, she goes and plays Halo. She's never played a fucking game in her life, but she goes and play it, and her friend Finn is, like, also online, and her campaign manager's daughter is, like, sit there next to her, and they're, like, owning fools, but, like, it's just so kind of, really?
Thanks, Microsoft product placement.
Like, I think it's Halo that they're playing, is it? Yeah.
I remember this now.
Oh, God, it's so awkward.
There is a made-for-Netflix Ricky Gervais movie that came out quite recently, very poorly critically received. I haven't seen it except for one scene where he plays a reporter in New York who fakes being a prisoner of war and has to keep up the ruse while hiding from his wife or something like that, or his ex-wife, in which, and we had to sign off on this, he randomly walks up to a newsstand in the street in New York halfway through a conversation, buys PC Gamer.
Goes, like, he asks mate. For it, doesn't
he? Hello, mate. Can I have a PC Gamer? And then it is never referenced again in that made for Netflix movie. But it does happen. And we had to sign off on that being okay. And we sent them an issue to use. You can't actually see it. It's not visible in the show. But yeah. So that is strange, and they specifically asked for it as well. So maybe Ricky Gervais reads PCG. I don't know because I don't know why they would pick.
Yeah, I guess, like, and also just any TV episode where anybody is playing a controller as if it's like as if it's alive and trying to escape from them. And oh my goodness,
it's always like I can sort of handle the fake games in TV better than when real games show up. Though I think it's weirder when it's real stuff.
I guess that's because it's more likely to have been, like, shoehorned in. Like, there's an episode of Gossip Girl where Blair's mum, and, like, the whole thing has clearly been, like, sponsored by Microsoft or whatever, because that show is rife with product placement. But there's a moment where they're talking about, I don't know, like, finding some piece of information out, and her mum just goes, why don't you just Bing it? And it's like, oh my god, I feel dirty.
Do you remember the A9.com thing in the OC?
No,
somebody
just
in Congress says, I think it might be Seth, and it's like, someone says, oh, how do you know that? Oh, A9.com did it last night.
Oh my god.
And they swear blind it's not product placement. And you're like,
the worst computer games episode of a TV show of all time is the episode in the first season of Veronica Mars where she has to go solve a crime at the Cyber Games Cafe, which involves that she has to dress up as, like, a Japanese schoolgirl, magical girl with a wig
Otherwise
the nerds won't speak to her. It's honestly, for a show that is otherwise quite well observed when it comes to, like, young people things, it is the most spectacular, like, hello fellow kids moment they could have had. Speaking of television,
okay.
Someone else who is called Will writes, Howdy, Chris and Pipbar Tomcast. TV writer Dan Harmon once said on the subject of television, if you ask a toaster what the most important thing in the world is, it's going to say bread. If you ask it what its opinion of bread is, it'll say it's not toasted enough. So let's look at television as an appliance. What do you think it's doing? It's making you watch it. Is your neighbor racist? Is it dangerous to go outside? Fuck yeah, says the television. Whatever you do, stay in your living rooms, and it will tell you anything to make that happen. So he continues, are games like Destiny and Overwatch unethical because, at the risk of oversimplifying, the ultimate goal is to keep playing them? It's often hard to shake the feeling they resemble over-elaborate free-to-play tower defense smartphone games. I realize most games want you to keep playing them, but is there a crucial difference between the ethics of a legacy multiplayer game like Counter-Strike and a persistent one like MOBAs, whose sciences of engagement, community design, incentive structure are incredibly exacting and refined? For purposes of clarity, I'm leaving out the word manipulative, as undersung community designers like those at Riot, have done astounding things, nudging toxicity from their player base. I remember Jonathan Blowtalk describing how WoW is similarly unethical to Farmville because the ultimate purpose is to increase relative stats. It's compelling, but also tempting to then ask what any game... I think he means this argument is compelling, but also tempting to then ask what any game played just for fun is supposed to do, which quickly feels nihilistic, grown-up-ish, and needlessly divisive. It's hard to approach without asking better questions. I'd love to hear if you have any thoughts on this. Oh, he just said he would also like to hear if we have any thoughts on this current golden age of long-form YouTube essay video criticism. It would be great to hear someone like Matthew Matosis guest on the podcast, or the Fail Forward fellow, should he ever start doing more of those, which he should. Marsh Davies, I'm talking about Marsh Davies, who should make more Fail Forward. Appreciations from Texas, Will. So there's two parts there. Are games unethical for having rewards, number, relative number-based reward progression system medus?
I think there's a subtle difference between a lot of games in that a lot of phone games want to trap you and trick you into playing forever, whereas a lot of other games just want to be interesting whenever you choose to play.
Mm. There's also a lot of games really incentivize you to come back to them. Like, a lot of games don't really care how long you play in a session, and in fact some really don't want you to play too long in a session, but they want you to come back tomorrow. Like, they don't want you to forget about it for a month. And so that's a particular thing, and loads of mobile games have like a daily bonus. Like, every day that you check in, you get this new bonus. And so if you leave it multiple days, you don't get an extra bonus. So you might as well come back every day, and then you're maximizing your bonus. And even Overwatch gives you like a big XP boost for the first win of the day, which encourages you to play every day. But Overwatch, I was going to cite that as an example of like, oh, Overwatch isn't trying to ask you to play constantly. But then Overwatch does also give you a bonus for consecutive matches. So every consecutive match you play, you get an extra bunch of XP for that. So in a sense, it is. I think that's more about not quitting, like not tantrum quitting, which is something I'm prone to do. I don't think they necessarily want you to play like a huge number of hours. Like my faith in game developers here is not that I think they're not immoral. It's that I don't think it's in their interest for you to play a huge amount of their game. Like, if you just play the game and nothing else, it becomes very hard for them to keep up with you in terms of content. Like, you'll always be angrily asking for the next thing when they haven't made it yet. And I think they'd much rather, they want to be a big part of your life, but they don't want to for you to sink a huge number of hours into their thing, because they're worried that either their game design or their amount of content won't support it.
I think the other thing to, maybe an interesting delineation here to make between something like WoW or LoL or Dota or Overwatch and a phone game, or like a exploitative phone free-to-play game, is that in a lot of the former cases, the kind of making numbers get bigger system, whatever form it takes, kind of is the kind of the boring filler for what is fundamentally like a meaningfully social thing. So everyone making their numbers get higher is the principle that sustains genuine human cooperation when it comes to raid teams and things like that, and that applies to Destiny or WoW. Or it's the thing that makes, you know, making your rank get higher is the thing that sustains genuine social interaction between people in a competitive game. And that is rewarding, genuinely rewarding, in a way that is, I think, sort of valuable and rather independent of whatever the developer's kind of machinations are. Whereas I think more often than not, a lot of the most exploitative phone games sell themselves to you on the basis of a sort of social thing they'll give you, which is like, there was an advert, I think, running before movies last time we went to the cinema, which was like loads of like sexy business people in the street who are then dressed in medieval armor, but then giving each other winky faces, like like they hook up in the game, but then they're going to have sex later. Like, and it's like,
this sounds realistic and appealing to me.
Whereas the game itself, chances are, offers almost nothing of that, and it's very solipsistic. Make the numbers get bigger in your city, and allegedly there might be something going on in someone else's, but it affects you in so much as makes some numbers change elsewhere.
I know the advert you're thinking of, and I totally did not get that from it. We had such a different.
You didn't get the bit where they walk past each other in the street, and the woman, like the sexy business lady, like taps the phone, and then he gets a request saying "Alliance accepted," and then he's like, "Yeah."
Well, like, but
that's a sex thing.
But it didn't feel like it was, because it felt like the point of the advert was just that everyone is playing this thing and that you're left out. Like, literally everybody who is going about their daily lives and being in, like, the coffee shop or wandering down the street or crossing the road or whatever is, like, secretly playing, what was it, like, Clash of Clans?
Clash of Kings, Kings of Time.
I don't know. But it was something like that.
Clash Royale.
And so to me, it wasn't this promise of like this social life. It was more just this normalizing, like literally everyone around you is playing this, so it's okay, and you should totally get in on that
I think you're being left behind. I think that's an element of it, and it's a bit insidious in itself. But I think that there's definitely a tradition of those kinds of games playing angles, traditional exploitative marketing angles that a lot of more core games or whatever don't. It's the traditional, let's say the Evony banner ad, which is always like a buxom wench saying, "Come build a castle, my lord." Like, it's always this shit constantly. And I get what you're saying. Like, I think a big chunk of that advert is just people of all walks of life all playing this game. It's just that the last thing in the advert is, I think, really explicitly selling on sex.
Yeah, but I mean, even with the Evony stuff, that's more about just getting people to your game. It's not about keeping them in the game. Like, that's just banner advertising. Like, that's, you know, and obviously not just, because there are really insidious practices there, but what I would say is that these things kind of operate on a spectrum. And so you have, you know, the most exploitative games on phone, but also on PC at one end. You know, like there's a whole bunch of like casual game stuff that just force you to install a bunch of third party nonsense that will like continually harass you. And like, you know, if you're super into hidden object games, then some of the providers of those are really bad for that kind of stuff on PC. But like, then, you know, I think a bit further along from that, you have core games like Assassin's Creed or like any number of Ubisoft ones, which just pepper a landscape with a bunch of markers that you feel compelled to clear up, even though there is absolutely no pleasure in doing so beyond getting through a to-do list. And I think that things like that feel like they are jealously sort of staking a claim on your time, because the core game, like the core experience of the game, the story, can be done and dusted long ago, but it's still making these continual demands on your time and sort of going, hey, there's more, you haven't 100%ed it.
The thing is, like, I know you hate Assassin's Creed, so...
Well, like, anything like that, though. But, like, Skyrim, I don't like it.
So
like, I love Skyrim and I hate that shit.
Like, I think... I don't think a mini month full of activities is a problem in and of itself, or is manipulative in and of itself, but it's based on, like, it's not a good substitute for having a good basic game. But if the basic game is good, and a mini month full of activities just gives you the, like, I think probably the good example of this is Far Cry, where it's probably the only game where you're delighted to see a big mini map full of outposts, because the core loot, like the core stealth mechanics and guns and stuff, are the bones is fun enough that you will do a variation on the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, with Far Cry games, it tends to be like the outpost things, I want to do all of those, and then like in Far Cry Primal, the assassination missions, I want to do all of those, and then everything else is just an icon, I don't care what it is.
Mm.
It's a thing,
but there is still a compulsion element to it, otherwise they wouldn't have, you know, achievements for doing particular things that are just spending time in a game, you know, and you can be more kindly disposed to them, or you can sort of view them more sort of beneficently or whatever, but like it often I think comes down to your own personal sort of where you're at with a game experience as to where you would put it on that spectrum. For example, with Dota, like I'm not enjoying it at the moment, and I think a lot of people would just say, yeah, but you know, doing the same thing over and over again means I'm learning more and more, but I really don't feel that at the moment. And it's just like this thing is sort of like has managed to get its hooks into me and has built it has become part of my life in a very particular way that makes it actually quite hard not to feel compelled to play it at particular points. And that means committing 45 minutes to an hour of not enjoying myself. How does
it compel you to play it?
There's a bunch of things, like, as in, Dota's an interesting one because it doesn't actually have those intrinsic reward mechanics exactly, but it's got... I mean, I've spent so much time in it and invested a lot of money, so there's a sunk cost to it. Like, there's 2,000 hours, frankly. but also, it became, because of those 2,000 hours, it became part of my social life as well. Yeah. And so there are a bunch of people that I don't get to speak to if we don't play that game. Or it becomes really awkward. It becomes sort of not part of the norm. And so I've had times when I've wanted to hang out with people, but they were all playing Dota. And so I've sort of put myself in a situation where it's like, you know, and I think that can be quite awkward. And obviously that's not necessarily a Valve problem, but it is still a kind of, time is such a precious resource to me. And I feel a bit resentful when I'm in a situation where it feels like I've been... where I'm not making the best use of it. And I, you know, I think that there is obviously value in the entertainment side of things, because otherwise you could just sit there and say, oh, I could always be doing something more worthwhile with my time. Like, I could be learning a language. I could be saving a life. I could be, I don't know, like building something. But so that's not to take away from the gaminess. It's more just like, I mean, it's the reason that I play all random or mid in League, because I just don't want to do another thing that takes 45 minutes or, you know, whatever else. It's, I want to engage with it in a different way, but like the push is always there. There was an interesting talk at GDC actually about it was by two brothers, I think it was, and I think one of them was a lawyer and one of them was an academic, and they were talking about how essentially video games are going to have to learn to regulate themselves on those fronts, because otherwise someone else is going to come in and do it for you, which is kind of interesting, and it's sort of already started on in some ways. But yeah, so I don't know, like I think I feel a bit differently about it to certainly to Chris, but like
I think we're just coming at it from a very different angle. I think it's the same argument, but I mean the only thing I wanted to clarify is that when I was talking about the advertising for the social, for like the phone games, I was saying that they lean very heavily on a social element in their advertising that isn't actually present in the game. And then maybe they do that to normalize games or for whatever marketing reason they do it. But even though some of the mechanics are the same, for me, there's an interesting distinction between something like WoW that has a very definite mandatory social element that's become a big part of people's lives, and games that advertise themselves heavily on that basis but don't actually do it. And that being a kind of differentiator between the two in some kind of abstract sense of worthiness.
Yeah, I guess for me, it just like it didn't feel like it was saying that, because I'm so used to games adverts not really being able to convey what you do in a game. And so relying on like almost like metaphors or like, you know, all kinds of weird shenanigans. And so I don't know.
Well,
like,
I mean, you'd have to break it down, but I suspect that adverts for mobile games, free-to-play games, that kind of thing, use those kinds of metaphors, very abstract metaphors, and live action and stuff like that far more regularly than traditional games, which normally advertise themselves with a cinematic or something like along those lines. Mm-hmm. Anywho.
Sorry, very just quick aside, just a personal bugbear. I've seen lots of it in the E3 footage. Can we do a public service announcement about trailers having a little... bar of text at the bottom saying game engine footage?
Oh my god, I hate that so much. As if that means
absolutely anything at all.
Oh my god, it basically just means not gameplay.
Yeah, it's not gameplay. It is absolutely no different at this point from a pre-rendered Pixar trailer.
Oh my god.
I think everyone's probably seen videos of a million oil drums blowing up in Crisis and stuff like that. Yeah. And they, you see them on YouTube playing back at 30 frames a second, and the engine processed them at less than one frame a second. And that's all that these Frostbite engines are doing. They can render absolutely anything to any quality, and as long as they put, and they are completely truthful in writing game engine footage, and it means absolutely nothing at this point. So please don't get swayed by that at all. I wanted to die.
That's not the hill you die on, John.
Was it related to that?
I might clip this bit out and just put the sound bite on the end of every article I write that actually has that to save me from like doing my traditional.
I actually did believe that Battlefield 1 was an immersive experience about trying to let the dove out of a tank. And that trailer lied to me.
Is that what the trailer was?
Yep. Good. Bunch of screaming God. Men letting a dove out of a tank.
Symbolic.
Symbolic of many things. War, tanks, doves.
But you see what men. I mean? Like, that's why I didn't look at that other trailer and go, oh, yeah, social stuff. I was like,
I guess for
probably,
me, this is...
Maybe they're trying to let their own inner doves out of the coffee shop or something.
Aren't we all?
We are, Tom, we are.
Let the dove of peace out of the tank of our
soul. I think I disagree about that, but we've laboured this point too much. So. Andrew writes, and this is actually more of a sort of point of fact, an interesting one rather than a question. I'm a few weeks behind on the cast, so someone else may have already sent it along, but they didn't, so congratulations. But the comedic voice of the Saints Row games came largely from former Volition head writer / creative director Steve Jaros. Steve has since moved on to Valve, so he now writes for games that only Gabe Newell gets to play. He says, can you imagine if this is what was actually happening at Valve, a power drunk Gabe Newell hiring writers and designers to make games that only he plays between knife sharpenings. Don't have a question, just thought I might find that info edifying, which it is edifying, because I genuinely didn't know kind of where that extraordinary kind of wit in the Saints Row games came from.
Kind of a shame that the guy has left.
Yeah, do you feel it's lacking in the latest trailer, which I can't remember the name of?
Agents of Mayhem?
It's called. Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, I didn't see it.
I think it is called that, but...
It looked awful.
I can imagine it being fun. But Saints Row is so, like, wise. I think it had to go through its adolescence first. It had to be that, like, the kind of cool gangster game first, and then it could be, like, isn't that stupid? Whereas this is the first draft of this thing, and so it's still, aren't these agents cool?
Serious times.
Quinn writes, Dear proprietors, you've been approached by the powers that be and asked to host a conference at the next E3. If none of these existing conferences take your fancy, you're allowed to curate your own. Which company's conference would you choose to host, and if you made your own, what would it entail? I also have a question for Chris specifically. Do you like Star Wars because you like spaceships and sword fighting, or do you like spaceships and sword fighting because you like Star Wars? Your goal in Southwest London, Quinn. Heart emoji thing. To answer the second bit, I think we can gloss both answers by saying I'm a 28-year-old child.
I remember like a distinct moment of realizing like thinking about like fantasy and sci-fi and swords and guns and stuff, and then realizing, oh, Star Wars has both these things. That's why it's super successful.
Yeah.
They figured out a way to do both.
I imagine I do like both of those things because I like both of those things. Although, actually, I like sword fighting because of the Princess Bride. 100% because of the Princess Bride. And not a lot because of Star Wars. Because Star Wars doesn't really actually have any good sword fights in it. It's got... actually, apart from maybe the new film. Because the ones in the original trilogy are a bit staid and they're good from a character point of view, but they're not, like, brilliant choreography. The ones from the new trilogy are lame. And I will boringly argue with you if you think anything else.
Nope.
Because it's just acrobatics with no real meaning. And the one, the new one's quite good because everyone looks sweaty and upset by it, which is my measure of a good hitting each other with laser swords.
But I really like Yoda's sword fight bouncing around in Attack of the
Clones.
Clones, was it? Third. One.
Revenge of the Sith. Revenge Maybe. Of the Sith is when he throws a lot of chairs at people.
I don't know. But, like, I went to see it with my friend's little kid brother and he was like 11, and I had had a lot of sugar, and we both had quite a good time at a Star Wars prequel movie, and I thought Yoda was pretty great tumbling around.
It would be fine if these were cartoons for children and not serious literature for grown-ups. This is the crucial mistake you've made. If this wasn't dignified fiction for adults with literature degrees... and was instead a big garish cartoon for children that didn't mean anything. Then I would see, you think you had a point. Film? Attack of the Clones.
That was the one, wasn't it? When they were all in the big circle and Samuel L. Jackson was there.
Yeah.
That,
yeah. Big, a little preview of Pip and I's Star Wars, intermittent Star Wars recollection series here. Yeah, but...
Are you going to do the prequels as well?
No. We actually started when we rewatched the films and... you know, Pip suggested starting from the beginning, but we got half an hour into The Phantom Menace before we became overwhelmed by how shit and racist it is. Which I said would happen.
You seemed actively sad.
It hurts me.
What was the question that wasn't the one about
you've
Star
been asked
Wars?
By the powers that be to host a conference the next E3.
I would actually like to say that I really loved the alternative that Keith started in E2. Which was because he couldn't get to E3 1 year, Keith from The Guardian, Keith Stewart. And so he teamed up with a bunch of other people and put on an alternative in a basement of a games-themed bar in London. And
I was there.
Yeah.
And this is where me and John met in real life.
Aww.
I was there showing Gunpoint, and I was showing it to loads of people, and quite a few people came up to me and said, something to the effect of like, oh, are you the developer of Gunpoint? And, said, yeah. And someone came up and said, oh, are you the developer of Gunpoint? And I said, yeah, and I'm the artist of Gunpoint. Oh, hi!
That's so awesome.
Aww.
But yeah, so because during the day in the space, there were people showing games and it was a whole load of like indie stuff and it was really cool and people could like actually sort of mill around and meet just interesting people doing interesting things. And then in the evenings, they would like clear away all of the stuff and have like seating, and they would then broadcast like just a bunch of cool indie developers talking about what they were working on. And like there was a sort of rotating cast of hosts and stuff. And it was just really friendly and nice and sort of sweet and like just enough of a shambles to be endearing, but like also just sort of very watchable and stuff. And then the next time it was on, it was as Radius Festival, and now I think it's kind of like maybe a touring thing. I think they held it in Vienna this year, so I couldn't go, but like I just really loved that. And the PC gaming show has elements of that because it has the sort of the sofa chat and the sort of the indie gaming sort of side of things and mentions of mods and things. But like it was still sort of enough of a like small thing that it felt like seeing friends and seeing people who were just genuinely sparked up by what they did, but it hadn't gone through a big PR machine, because that's what that's what E3 feels like to me. It's just this orgy of marketing flimflam, essentially.
It's a spectacular flimflam.
Absolutely hate it.
There's flim and there's flam.
I would choose to host Microsoft conference because I feel like that's the one that needs the most
help.
Yeah.
What, it needs another white dude. On stage.
I wouldn't be on stage. Right, well, I guess it says hosting. Okay, no, then no.
Sorry.
I don't know. I guess I'd like to be on the PC gaming one. I guess what I quite like actually is kind of like, almost like a critical digest of indie games, because everyone does, like, the big hitters are just, like, whatever big hitters are around, like, whoever has a cool game that's coming out that's a huge deal that everyone's going to care about anyway. Then the indie stuff, almost everyone does it now, and it's cool. But then at the kind of, at the big conferences, certainly the platform holder conferences, it's like, who have we sponsored? Who are we publishing ourselves? And that kind of stuff. And it'd be quite cool to have like an indie section where it's just like, here's what we as an editorial team have decided are the 10 most exciting games that are currently in development, and that kind of stuff.
I think we could all just enjoy hanging out with Day 9, though.
Yeah.
Lovely Sean.
He just seems like such a sweetie.
It's funny, like, him and Aisha Tyler are the only two E3 hosts who just kind of, like, have a certain smoothness about them. Mm. And that's not to say that everything goes smoothly. It's just that, like, whatever happens, they'll just make the best of it. And
I think
they're
just, like, decent with people, you know? And, like, because I was watching the Manila Major, which was a recent Dota 2 tournament, and the sort of backstage host guy who was doing the interviews with players and stuff is a guy called Sir Action Slacks. And he was, and some of the interviews were incredibly awkward, but like he just seemed so genuine and pleased to like see everyone and, you know, was never shitty or snippy to them. And it was just really lovely. And I quite liked that sort of, I think I just like things that feel like they're always on the verge of a shambles, to be honest, but... Yeah.
I think mine would be E3, but with a dedicated snark panel just on the live feed at the same time. Like the Muppets.
Like Statler and Waldorf.
Exactly.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Just dedicated feed of carefully selected, sarcastic British commenters. It could just be incredibly dry and undermine the whole thing.
Farming retweets quietly at the site.
Do you have like a sort of casting for this in mind? Because I'd really love like Patrick Stewart to just be off like, the commentary. I don't know why. Just
I think Graham Norton would be my choice.
Just such a good job with Eurovision. You're thinking of Eurovision, yeah.
He has like just the right balance of like sympathy and snark because he'll
maybe or like what? Who was it in the? Because it was Sue. No, Mel from Mel and Sue. Mm. And
okay, actually, yeah, just Mel and Sue.
Yeah, basically Mel and Sue. I think that would be really good. Oh, it would be like the Bake Off. Oh, they should just do something nice like Bake Off.
The Dev Off.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Travis writes, this is our last question of the evening. Hello, he writes, best tarp in a video game.
It's a tarp.
It's a tarp, said.
Admiral Akbar.
Yeah.
Or Akbar.
My sister and I once conceived of a Star Wars themed buffet restaurant called Admiral Akbar's Admirable Snack Bar, which is a crying shame will never happen. Thanks, Disney.
Thanks, Obama.
Travis continues. His vote, my vote, he writes, goes for Metal Gear Solid 5 Ground Zeroes. Wonderfully wet canvas, slapping in the wind. All the best, Travis.
I like that. I can't Travis believe. Was writing to reach us. Is that not... Are we not?
That,
does nobody
that
reference know Travis's
is actually
back catalogue?
Before my time.
Okay. Oh my god.
Heard Travis, the pop star.
They were banned, but they had a song called Writing to Reach You.
I remember the song Driftwood, but that's all.
Yeah.
I sent my Travis knowledge.
It's fine. Let's
also,
move
I
on.
Thought it was like one guy. I assumed it was a guy called Travis. I didn't know. I strongly disagree with this question. The best wet tarp, I'm amazed to find I have an opinion on this. I was recently playing Uncharted 4, and I specifically like multiple screenshotted and then ultimately recorded and gifted the wet tarp in Scotland. It's actually like, I think it's a recurring prop. But there's a bunch of crates you hide behind, and some of them are covered in a bright blue tarp, and that tarp is wet because it's Scotland, and the reflections are fucking amazing. And just like moving the camera around and watching it glint in the sun, like, holy shit, how do they make this tarp so good?
I strongly disagree.
Wow.
There's
it's a
point,
hot button topic
in Mass Effect 3 where you're on Mars, you exit the main chamber and go out onto like the surface of the station. At which point there is like tarp-covered surfaces in front of you, which are being whipped by the Martian wind as a snowstorm comes in, and it's 100% done in the shader. Whoever set that up is a master of material nodes. It should be celebrated.
Wow. This is the hill you die on, John. This is it. This is the artist's hill. Video, like, yeah, I think I'm going to be the tarp tiebreaker here, and I'm going to vote for the Mass Effect tarp.
Yeah.
Partly because I feel like this is John's field of expertise. And also partly because he said the word Mass Effect.
I'm voting for Tom's because I've seen his, because I watched all of those screenshots unfold across multiple tweets. They were gorgeous.
Another great game of top tarps.
I think
it's a top tie.
It's a top tie and top tarps. A top top. Shit.
We're all tapped out.
We're all tapped out of top tarps. So it's time to finish the podcast.
If you'd like to send us a question, you can do so at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can leave them on our forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum. You can, are there other ways? Twitter. You can tweet them at us. We are at Creight and Crowbar on Twitter. And you can also follow us individually. I am at Pentadact, which is PentAdact. Chris is...
at C Thurston, which is CthurstEn.
Pip is...
I am at Philippa War, which is PhilippaWarr.
And John is...
JohnAwrr.
Thank you for listening, everybody!
Good tops. Good tops, good times, good friends.